Internet casting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
This episode of the FX Podcast is brought to you by Side Effects Software, makers of Houdini, a faster, easier, and more productive workflow, giving artists more control in their day-to-day work. Find out more from the Side Effects Software website, sidefx.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX Podcast. The FX Podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out all of our podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. In this episode, Mike Seymour travels to New Zealand to speak with Dave Clayton, animation supervisor for Weta Digital, about animation on The Hobbit, An Unexpected Journey. This is just part of our coverage. Make sure you check out the feature story titled The Hobbit, Weta Returns to Middle Earth, and keep an eye out for an FX Guide TV episode as well. The film has already set a new December opening day box office record and could be a big factor in propelling the U.S. box office for the year to a new high. Variety recently pointed out that this holiday season is the most congested ever, with 7 wide releases coming between December 19th and Christmas Day. Speaking of the holidays, if you're looking for a gift for a visual effects artist, make sure you consider the gift of career growth with a gift certificate from fxphd.com. You can buy a whole FXPhD term for someone or pay for an extra course if they're already an existing member. This also makes a great gift to employees. If you want more information, head over to fxphd.com, and on the right side you will see the production blog, or just drop us a line at the Contact Help tab at the top of the page. All right, well, let's get into this episode as we travel with Mike Seymour to New Zealand and Weta to chat with Dave Clayton.
So, all creatures great and scary, huh? It must be really interesting to be revisiting some characters from sort of Lord of the Rings with new technology and new characters that you've never done before. Maybe we should start with revisiting old friends.
Sure.
Gollum is essentially the same character but new again?
Yep, that's correct. Obviously we want to kind of bring him in line with the latest kind of cutting-edge technology. You know, at the time, 10 years ago, 9 years ago, he was cutting-edge. Everyone responded very well to him. This time round, there's an expectation that we'll preserve his expressions, his look, but, you know, so much has changed and sort of progressed in the last 10 years that you've kind of got to bring him forward and really kind of increase the detail of him just to kind of preserve the expectations that surround Gollum, if that makes sense. You know, you've...
So since Prometheus and before, there have been advances at Weta in terms of subsurface scattering that would cause Gollum to be rendered differently. But I'm wondering, from an animation point of view, was the rigging different?
Yes. The same sort of general premise around his puppet controllers and everything apply. I think the biggest advances would be in his face and his facial controls. Avatar was probably the first kind of foray into rebuilding our facial systems with the FAX setup. And so we've just been applying that to all our characters from that point on, and it's really effective. It's kind of like just a benchmark for every face is built with the same structure. But on someone like Gollum, you've got to just go that bit further. You know, you've got to study all the wrinkles around his face. It's really just studying Andy from like an infinitesimal level, just seeing, you know, like his skin slides over his cheekbones in this certain way when he pulls a certain expression. You know, that the fact solver's not going to give you that out of the box. You need to layer in much more control, just little fine controls for compression of his lips, say. Veins, you know, we'd copy where the veins would form on Andy's face. And then, you know, in a shot, you can just really observe those details in Andy, apply them to Gollum, and, you know, you're kind of getting close to having that level of kind of realism then. So
there's a lot more blend shapes in this version of Gollum, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you might have your standard kind of 120 fax shapes, but then there's probably an extra 120 of just custom shapes just specifically for Gollum, yeah.
So Gollum would be a very close to sort of source motion capture, wouldn't it, especially in terms of facial performance?
Yes, yep. I mean, you know, our main our primary goal is to just get that feeling and the look of Andy coming across in Gollum. So, you know, you have to, the computer's going to kind of, you know, connect the dots and kind of get you most of the way there, but it really takes a trained eye and our animators and our facial animators just to transpose that performance from one to the other. And it's like, well, yes, the lip might be cutting the same line, but when I look at Andy, what feeling do I get? Now when I look at Gollum, do I get that same feeling? And so it's kind of, you know, you really have to be kind of just checking every revision to just make sure that, yes, the emotional response is there. You know, we could just constantly update our facial puppet. So, you know, if we came across a specific shot where Andy was just incredibly angry and we saw veins popping out and tension in his eye bags or cheeks or anything, I could just have Alessandro, who did the facial puppet, can you just add a cheek tension slider for us? It's got to do this, and it's got to be for this shot. And, you know, he'd give us a first pass and then we'd dial it in, and then he might go and adjust his shapes and combinations based off our animation curves. Yeah, there's one shot in question where that comes to mind, where Gollum is getting very kind of irate as he's trying to think of an answer to one of the riddles, and Andy just went to town with it and basically just pulled all these crazy facial expressions like he was really straining. And it was kind of overwhelming to see it at first, but, you know, when you break it down into just individual muscles and movements and you really study them, we were able to kind of replicate that in Gollum, and the final result's really, it's a really entertaining shot.
I guess there's also an increase in image fidelity, in the sense that a subtlety that may have been lost or at least not so obvious at 2K, perhaps at 48 frames at 5K, is sort of a bit more visible. Do you think the animators had to think about any of that in terms of...
Yes, definitely. It was in the forefront of our minds, because not only 48 frames a second, but we've never seen Gollum in stereo 3D. And you need a lot more detail. You can't get away with any cheats. You know, just the scrutiny that you're looking at this stuff is magnified a lot.
And I imagine characters like the trolls are a lot less sort of a one-to-one relationship, especially when it comes to facial animation, just simply because there's a lot further to travel in terms of retargeting.
Yes, there is. The facial designs were very kind of just a lot broader, and, you know, eyes, nose, different positions, you know, like you say, just a lot further to kind of transpose. But on top of that, there's a scale difference, a huge scale difference. The trolls are kind of 4 meters high. And as well as that, I think there was just a bit more room for sort of stylization of performance, you know, which sort of balancing the fact that these creatures, these beasts, as they were in Lord of the Rings, that sort of maybe grunted and roared at most, are now kind of conducting drama scenes where they... You know, they discuss recipes with Bilbo.
You could almost say it's comedy as well. And so from a comic point of view, I guess you really can't judge that timing until you see the final animation.
Yeah, that's true. You need to... Because, you know, to apply sort of a one-to-one mocap to a troll is going to look light. It's going to look lightweight and kind of... Yeah, comical in the wrong way. So you have to slow things down. You have to add weight. You really have to kind of redefine some of the poses to feel like they've got that natural kind of gravity and stuff. And from there, you can start layering in the facial. And I think that was probably the biggest challenge, actually, on the trolls. I mean, we've done big creatures before that were mocap based, and then, you know, had layers of animation to kind of give them the correct weight. But we haven't really done that with a speaking character. And you know, oftentimes the trolls speak quite quickly, like almost kind of unexpectedly quickly, because the scene flies through pretty quick. And so the challenge there is to make the dialogue and the lip sync feel, obviously, like the troll is saying those lines, but he's saying it in a way that doesn't blow the scale of his face and performance. So that was a real new challenge for us.
So I think there's a misconception that sometimes all of this is coming from motion capture. And, of course, motion capture is very, very valuable, and it's great for the director to be able to direct with it. Mm-hmm. But discuss me that balance, because sometimes it really does come down to reinterpreting that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And, I mean, the trolls are a good example for that, because Peter was able to work with the three actors who were playing the trolls, and he was able to go to the mocap stage and walk through the scene, choreograph it in different ways, and then just do a few takes, start to kind of enhance the interactions and stuff as you would on a live action shoot. And then he was able to sit and select the mocaps that he felt kind of you know, gave him the performance that he wanted the shots to loosely be. But from there, when we applied those motions to the trolls and started really, you know, getting into the details, it became apparent that, yes, we need to slow it down a lot. Maybe some of the performances just aren't right. We can, you know, if a troll's jumping up and down, for example, you know, on the day you've got a man jumping up and down, it's got a certain weight and physics to it. You apply that to a troll, it's just way, way too fast. And the more you slow it down, the more it just kind of gets a bit sort of wishy-washy. So you have to, like in the case of that shot where the troll gets kind of, he gets hacked in the leg by one of the dwarves and he jumps up and down, we just keyframed it from scratch, basically, just using the performance Peter Select as sort of just like a blocking pass in a way.
I imagine a similar thing would happen with the Goblin King, because again, you've got a larger scale, mm-hmm. But also some real comic interesting performances. You want to bring that performance through, but adjust to that much vaster scale than Barry Humphries has naturally.
Yes, definitely. I mean, the Goblin King, of course, he's bigger than a human actor, but as well as that, he's got some very physical... quite disgusting physical attributes that really inhibit his movement. He's got a massive belly. He's got a massive kind of hanging wattle on his neck. So all these kind of what could be considered constraints, we actually just sort of embraced and sort of thought, well, how can we make this work for us? And so we'd kind of inhibit the movement of his head a little bit, but try to get him looking in certain directions in other ways, like lumbering his whole body around, for example. The other thing of note with the Goblin King is that Barry Humphries did the facial and the voice performance, and we had Terry Notary, who's a movement coach on the show. He did a lot of the more dynamic body motions because he's just really physical and good at moving around. So we had to marry up a body from one actor, a face from the other, and try to, you know, have that come through in sort of a coherent way. So oftentimes we had to kind of, well, if that's Barry Humphries saying that line and doing that little head gesture there, let's try to fold that in with the body that we have from Terry and just try to glue it all together and just make it seem like a seamless performance.
It does seem to be real validity in terms of the performance coming through in the eyes. From having seen Barry Humphries' raw performance, he's very expressive with his eyes, and of course a lot of people would say the soul of any performance comes from the eyes. Can you talk to me about getting the eyes right? Because that seems to be like critical to that path.
Yes, it is. I mean, that's where the audience is looking, hopefully, in the eyes. So the first thing we do is we make sure our eyes are targeting a world target. So that means if the head's going to move around at all, the eyes will remain locked. Because what makes a character look dead is if their eyes just lock to their skull and it just sort of glazes them over immediately. You know, it's actually impossible to move your head and have your eyes move with. Your eye is always picking out targets. So that's step one, is to just make sure those eyes are locked down onto targets. The next step is, of course, just transpose the eye movements from the actor, make sure the timings and the spacings of the eye targets are right. But then, you know, maybe taking some artistic license. You know, the king is huge. His eyes might not be able to dart around as much as Barry's do. So, you know, he might pick two of the three eye darts he did and just sort of time them well to still preserve the essence of his performance.
Do we have more of a sense of where they're looking because of the stereoscopic space, because we have more of, as an audience, a sense of the space we're in?
Yes, definitely. And I'm working through a shot right now where... In 2D, you sort of don't see the plane of the iris. It's a real featured shot of an eye. And in 3D, because you're seeing kind of two perspectives of that eye, you see the plane of the iris, so you know exactly where he's looking. And so it just takes a bit more craftsmanship to just really pick the best angle of that eye to get the most, you know, out of that shot, you know?
And if you have to build on a performance for someone like the king or the trolls... When we get to the dramatic rescue with the eagles, of course, motion capture really isn't relevant anymore at all.
No. That's the beauty and the attraction of The Hobbit from an animation standpoint, is that there's endless variety in the amounts of creatures, you know, from the wargs through the spiders to the...
Hedgehogs,
yeah. You know, we've got a whole host of new creatures that people might not be expecting in the film, that like rabbits, which are, you know, 100% keyframed, of course. And you know, it's great to work on as well, because you've got Gollum, who's, you know, primarily mocap based. You've got the trolls, which are a real sort of blend of two worlds, mocap and keyframe animation. And then you've got something like the Eagles, which is just 100% animation. And so it sort of rounds out the...
Talk to me about the Hedgehogs and just much more, of course, the Eagles, because in a normal character, their skin is maybe clothed, but we get a real sense of skeleton to skin much more closely. But once you've got feathers, you can't animate the sort of the naked eagle without the feathers, and yet the feathers must add an enormous amount of computational problem to just... an animator working out the look of an eagle.
Yep, for sure. And, you know, we got our blocking passes done quite early on and mapped out all the shots pretty well. But the ongoing challenge has just been to get the fluttering of the feathers to feel, you know, like they're flying through the air at high speed, but they're not too small looking. You know, we have to make sure the scale is there. So it's just getting those, dialing those settings and making them look right. And then, yeah, of course... the Eagles are carrying the company, you know, they're carrying them to safety, so we have to make sure that we're leaving enough space for the company. Like, just say some dwarves are sitting on the back, you know, you have to just preserve a little bit of space there to allow the feathers to kind of sort of just conform to their legs and stuff.
And presumably digi-doubles come into this a lot, a blending between an actual performance and where it's just easier to be have your ensemble cast actually is digital doubles?
Yes, digital doubles, a massive part of it. And you know, the eagle sequence, full of keyframe eagles, of course, but the beauty of having access to the mocap stage is that we can just capture the company riding on eagles or being held in the eagle's claws. And what I love is that you put that mocap into the shot, so you have a keyframed eagle and then you have mocap dwarves, and it just boosts the realism straight away, because, you know, your eye picks out those realistic head moves and readjusts of the mocap dwarves, but you're getting to enjoy the graceful movements and keyframe movements of the eagle. So it's, yeah, I mean, I love mocap, and we totally embraced it on this movie. You know, you can use it to enhance a shot that's even primarily keyframe based.
And I seem to be reading that because of the digital doubles' quality and the fact that you could work with them so well, there are occasions where you would normally go to Roto to solve a problem with a character, and it was, in fact, easier just to swap the character out, because trying to Roto their hair at 5K resolution and 48 frames in stereo just meant it was easier to actually substitute. So, in fact, the animation team was also effectively helping the compositing team.
Yep, definitely, definitely. I mean, as you say, sometimes it's... you know, you're at a crossroads. Do we try to Roto and kind of paint back parts of this character that are being obscured by a, you know, a green screen guy or something? Or do we just, you know, commit to trying to get the digi-double looking really realistic and just go that way? And there's been, yeah, plenty of times when we've gone to the digi-doubles. And, you know, sometimes it's required because, for example, we have to scale up Gandalf, but he's too obscured by the dwarves and, you know, they're walking up a hill or something, so it was just going to be impossible to extract what we needed from the plate. So you just do a digital double game.
Presumably when these characters are interacting with fully digital characters like the Eagles as well, to sell that interaction, it's obviously a lot easier if they're manipulating limbs and or if their hands are touching a digital character, that it's
much easier. If they're existing in the scene along with the eagle, then, you know, your interactions are right there. But if you're trying to kind of work it around a green screen element, it can get quite tricky and start to look pretty fake. So in a funny kind of way, it's like, to get a more realistic looking result, you go to the digi double.
So for things like the rabbits and the things that say like the hedgehog and the eagles, did the animators have models that already had sort of low resolution cloth hair and fur?
Definitely. Yep. The rigging guys make sure we've got an extra layer that we can, you know, toggle on and off that accounts for the fur volume layer, basically. And you know, when you're sort of just nutting out your poses and that, you might have it switched off, but when you start getting into the details, you'll switch that back on, make sure there's no intersections and such. Yeah.
Because I can imagine with many of these characters, especially those that have robes or, you know, sort of, that in fact defining their animation is heavily defined by their silhouette, which in turn is defined by these cloth type things.
Yeah, totally. So you've got to be aware of that. But it's another case where I found mocap really helps for the digi doubles, because the motion, you know, it looks good in our animation scenes and it's like, okay, yep, that's feeling real, the mocap's transferred well. But when you get the sort of the cloth simulations and the final renders underway, that's where mocap really just reads as photoreal, because the cloth sims just respond so well to a mocap based performance, just because it's, you know, it is real. So it just the simulation, everything all just seems to come together a lot better if you've mocap those digidoubles.
So there are a couple of mountains that go for it in this film, and that poses a really interesting problem from a character animation point of view, because inherently Stone doesn't have a lot of flexibility, doesn't bend a lot. Tell me, how do you approach a problem like that where you need to have me as an audience member still believe they're Stone, though clearly they're doing all the things that an organic would do, bending, hitting, punching, needlessly fighting?
Yes. Well, I mean, that was definitely the challenge, how to articulate the limbs, especially of these big stone giants. What we had on our side is that they move very slowly, for starters, because, you know, to sell the mass, there just needs to be incredibly slow motions. And it was quite dark as well. But I think the way we got around it is by just sort of using ball joints and just having bits of stone fall away as say the elbow would rotate. You'd have kind of explosions of rock and stuff to kind of sell the idea that it's kind of going through this range of motion that's kind of breaking it apart, as it were, as it's moving.
Is there actually any kind of squash and stretch, to use that classic animation term? It's all very rigid.
Very rigid, yeah. You wouldn't be able to get away with any deformation of any kind. It's just you've got to use kind of ball joints in a way that kind of slot together seamlessly, and then if there is ever any collision, it's just kind of going to send off an explosion of rocks with the simulated explosion sim.
So that was all hand animated, and then sims overlaid based on intersection.
Yep. And for you know, just creative effect, dramatic effect. You know, certain points, you'd want to have, you know, some rocks just erupting out of the joints and stuff. Especially in the initial shots where we were trying to introduce the characters and sell the motion, we had rocks kind of falling away. You know, they've been asleep for thousands of years, presumably, so they're just covered in layers of rocks that are just constantly falling away. And that really sold the scale as well, you know, to see those rocks falling with gravity and that feeling quite slow. All of a sudden, you're aware of how big these things are.
What's an animator got to animate to? I mean, are they seeing, presumably they're seeing 48 frames, they're not seeing stereo, right, at their desk?
Not at their desk, no. The animators are definitely seeing the 48 frames in their scenes. And, you know, it was a bit of an adjustment, because everybody's used to watching film at 24 frames a second. We're calibrated to work at 24 frames a second. So it was a little bit jarring to begin with, but, you know, I'd say after a week or two, it was you were fine. You were into it and you were away. And now 24 frames a second just feels really kind of strobey and jerky to us, because we're just so used to it. We've been spoiled. And, you know, it's like giving a painter a whole extra set of brushes and a much bigger canvas to work with. It's like you've got twice as many frames to tell your story. You know, that's pretty cool.
So you motion captured people, but you motion captured more than just people, right?
Yep. Because we had access to the stage every week. We were just capturing for hundreds of shots. Basically, we got into a real rhythm of just capturing, and we were looking at the wog sequence early on, and Eric Reynolds made a good suggestion, which was, why don't we mocap a dog? And so we thought about what type of dog would be best, maybe a big German Shepherd or something with a lot of mass into it. But it actually ended up being most effective to capture Jake, who's the stagehand's dog.
What sort of a dog?
He caught me out here. I don't know. She's quite small, but it meant that she was much more kind of athletic, because she could jump over things, whatever. So Eric was able to capture this dog doing a variety of behaviours that then you'd get into the scene and you could slow it down again, like we did with other mocaps, for example, the trolls. You could just slow it down and get rid of the wagging tail. And all of a sudden you've got a library of motions that just, yeah, plug into your vision as real, because, you know, you can recognise those movements and those weight shifts as real. So that really gave us a head start on the wargs.
That weight shift you just touched on then is really central to selling a lot of these bigger characters, isn't it?
It is. I mean, if you've got a character just doesn't have to be doing too much, just needs to be in the shot. If you've got a nice weight shift in there that just sort of, you know, sells to the audience, it's there, it's real, it's got weight. You just accept it, you know, So, yeah, that's always what we're trying to do, you know, make the audience think that our character is real. You know, you want to kind of keep that suspension of disbelief there, rather than kind of just go, oh, that's an animated character there, isn't it?
And presumably the the, say, in this case, dog motion capture also gives you irregularities and non-symmetrical behaviour, which I guess also helps cell realism.
Yep, unexpected results. You know, the dog might have just done a certain thing at a certain time, and people are used to seeing people move. They're also used to seeing dogs move. So, you know, it's that sort of familiarity, but then when you sort of just, you know, break down the motion a little, add a bit more weight, slow it down a bit and put it on a warg, you've got a big warg, but it's just got those occasional realistic weight shifts and stuff that kind of just, yeah, you believe it is real.
Thanks to Dave for sharing with us. And as I mentioned at the top of the episode, this is just part of our coverage of this film. So head over to fxguide.com for so much more. Also, while you're at the site, check out the FX Insider program. It's a membership program we created in response to people asking how they could help FX Guide. The site is free and really has minimal advertising, which, by the way, if you're involved with a company and want to advertise on FX Guide, your ad will really pop and reach a lot of passionate visual effects artists. Anyway, FX Insiders get access to exclusive content and expanded articles. It's a way for people who care about visual effects and the work that we do here at FX Guide to help us continue to do more. Details are at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. And to advertise on the site, use the Contact tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. We also produce two other audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects and current releases, as well as classic films. The RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. We also produced a high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these, along with in-depth articles, news, and more, at fxguide.com. And also, as I mentioned at the beginning, check out our sister site, FX PhD, that offers extensive online visual effects training and gift certificates for the holidays. Well, that'll do it for this episode. For my partners, Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.